I'm Theo Vaughn, and I am joined today by our producer, co-host, Ari Manis.
Hello. Welcome back, Ari. I'm good to be here.
Yeah, it's
I'm glad
you
to
back,
be
man.
Here. Yeah.
And Matt Weiss is...
He's in Australia?
Yeah, he's
banging,
in Australia.
Banging dudes?
Could be. Good call, I think.
Why does he say that he's in Australia?
I don't know. Actually, it's a good question.
He said he's going down under.
That's the voice of Jimmy Vestwood, star, yeah. creator, and esteemed comedian Maz Jobrani.
Interesting that you said Jimmy Vestwood star. Is that what you mostly get recognized
basically,
from?
Yeah, around the world, yeah. they go, Jimmy Vestwood star. No, he came to the premiere. Theo came to the premiere. This was in 2014.
And was it that long ago?
Isn't that crazy, bro?
Yeah.
No,
I remember
not.
Seeing the ads all
no,
over
no,
the sorry, Laugh
last
Factory.
Year. We made it in 24. Oh, sorry.
sorry.
Was, last yeah. year. Yeah, you're right. You're right. 2016. Dang, sorry.
I'm like, Maz is traveling through time.
Yeah, a lot goes on in his life. It yeah. feels like forever ago.
Wow, man.
Yeah, man.
And that was amazing to see just for you to bring that from start to finish. Was that just unbelievably hectic?
Dude, I'm telling you, as a stand-up, you know, as stand-ups, we work in 15-minute intervals until you get a headlining, say, and you work in an hour interval, and then and writing a movie was just such a different beast. I have such respect for filmmakers because really, first of all, I don't know if stand-up comedians have less of an attention span or what, but you know, we get to go on stage on a nightly basis, do our stuff, but with a movie, you got to stick with it. And so the co-writer and I started writing the movie almost 10 years before, and we just didn't have funding, so we just kept writing, and it wasn't until right up towards the end of it where or close to the production time, we did a crowdfunding, got a few people that invested, and then suddenly we had the money and we're like, we gotta go.
I didn't realize you crowdfunded that. So you made that basically all yourself then?
We crowdfunded probably like a fifth of the budget.
Okay.
Once we had that, then we got investors that came on. And then even when you make the movie, now you're done. You go, oh, great. Now festivals are just going to eat us up. That's not the case.
Wow.
So then we ended up, in a festival, the Austin Film Festival, not South by Southwest, but Austin Film Festival. And we won a couple of prizes there for best comedy. Mm. And that's when I was like, oh, this is huge. And then it just kind of, then we had to find a distributor and we're a lower budget movie. Without any big names in it, and so
except for
moi. Yeah.
Well, and you had some guest stars in there too, and now we're talking. When you say lower budget, you're talking at least $1 million budget, right?
No, we were less than a million.
Oh, were you
yeah,
really?
Yeah, we were half a million. But it had a good look. Our DP, his name is Armando Salas. He really did a good job of making it look good. You learn little tricks. Like we had a scene at the beach, and they go, well, to make it look bigger, let's go above the beach and get a shot off the cliff of the whole ocean, and then let's go into the beach. You go, oh, that's a good idea.
Mm.
And it makes it look bigger.
Yeah.
So he did a great job, and I was very proud of the whole movie. Matter of fact, the main villain was John Hurt, who just passed away recently.
Really?
He played the bad guy in it. He passed away just like a week ago or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I wonder if that was one of his last, like...
Possibly.
Big hurrahs.
Well, he did Sharknado, so I don't know if he did Sharknado 2. I didn't watch that.
Yeah, there's 5 now. They just did 5.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Pretty much the same movie, right?
I think the sharks have, like merge with a different animal now.
Oh,
like
geez.
Shizards or something. Like a shizards. Like
oh,
there's like
yeah.
shark lizards out there.
That's great. I mean, how high do you have to be to work on that movie?
Dude, we had one of this. We had actually the star who the startlet of the new Sharknado 5 was just in. And the whole time I'm listening to him, I'm just like, man, this girl is pretty hot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you get her number?
I could not even hear a lot of what she was saying, dude. She was really charming and amazing. She's from Texas, but I was just kind of encumbered with some of her beauty, you know?
Look at that.
So I think that's the trick. They got the ladies and they got the sharks, you know?
That's all you
I want to see
bro.
It. You
that's
sold you me.
Need.
Now I want to see the movie.
Yeah.
Hey, Theo, you know what?
What?
It's a new month.
Dude,
so
I know.
That means a new Loot Crate.
Loot Crate.
And August's Loot Crate theme is...
It is...
Kingdom.
It is?
Yeah, Kingdom.
I just got mine yesterday. I didn't open it yet.
Oh, I didn't get mine.
You didn't?
In this August Loot Crate, you'll find items from Legend of Zelda...
Ooh.
Adventure Time and... The Lord of the Rings.
So it's probably going to be a good one. Legend of Zelda, I remember from growing up, and they've redone it over the years, and then I think it just came out with a brand new one.
Yeah.
Adventure Time, I'm not even familiar with, so I guess I'll learn about that.
Yeah, exactly.
But The Lord of the Rings... Everybody knows about.
Are you a Lord of the Rings nerd?
I'm not a nerd, but I definitely, you know, I like my Lord.
And I like my rings. Yeah.
It's the best surprise that you know is coming. Loot Crate offers an epic range of like pop culture items and nostalgia items for less than $20 a month.
There are monthly wearables and accessories with cult classics and your favorite franchises if you go to Lootware.
Yeah.
So you get some clothes too.
Yep, Lootware. And if you want to geek out your pet, you can try Loot Pets. So imagine just having like a fun surprise box that comes every month. It's going to have great things in it for you or for someone you care about.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you have like a kid or a family member or a friend, anyone who like you just want to kind of treat them to something neat every month.
Yeah.
They love nostalgia. Pick the nostalgia that's in their realm. Lootware, Loot Crate, Loot Pets.
I mean, and it's not over the top. It's easy. It's for items less than like $20.
Yeah.
And it is a great thing to get each month. So be the envy of your friends and get 100% exclusive. It's completely exclusive. Crates at lootcrate.com/allegedly. Mm-hmm. Enter the code Theo.
Yep.
When are we going to change that?
Ooh,
enter the code Theo to save 10% on any new subscription.
Yep, that's it. Lootcrate.com/allegedly. Enter the code Theo, T-H-E-O. August Loot Crate theme is Kingdom.
And this offer expires August 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific time. So you have to get in if you want the Kingdom Loot Crate.
Yep, get your Loot Crate now. It's every month it's different. It's a great surprise. I promise you, try it out for a month. See what you feel.
Yes. That's lootcrate.com/allegedly. Code Theo.
So Ari had a question before you came in. He's like, does Maz dislike Jews, you know?
Yeah, that was my first question.
That's a point for Ari right
now. Oh, great. Okay.
Getting that right.
And I was like, no, I said, I think Maz is Jewish.
No, I'm not Jewish, but I
was like, no, he's the opposite.
Yeah, right. He's the opposite of Jewish, which is Muslim, I guess. I don't know. In today's world. Yeah. There's a lot of Persian Jews. I have a lot of Persian Jewish friends. I have Jewish friends. I have Muslim friends. I'm not really religious, to be quite honest. I'm very secular. I mean, I was born in Iran.
Right.
And then we left Iran at the time of the Iranian Revolution. So we fled the Islamic Republic of Iran, basically. And my family was secular even back then. And
how old were you at the time?
I was six at the time. Wow. So for me, you know, religion, other people's religion has never been an issue for me. The only time religion was an issue was when I was in college. You're talking about hot girls. And I was like sitting on a bench and this kind of pretty girl came over and started talking to me. And I was like, oh, what? This doesn't happen. I was like, what? This is a beautiful day. And then the next thing I know, she's like, have you thought about going to church? And I was like, what? And then she's like, yeah, I have a,
one of those.
Church. Why do you come? I was like, oh, come on. And then she just kept insisting about the church. And finally, it's funny to kind of get rid of her. I was like, oh, no, I'm Muslim. And then she was, I'm not religious. I was like, right. I thought maybe
she probably
like,
never even heard of that.
Well, I thought maybe she'd be like, oh, you're not one of us. But she didn't even, because I think that kind of Christian, whatever that kind of Christian is, evangelical or whatever, it's like a telemarketer. Mm-hmm. Like they have an answer for you.
You
know? So I was like,
Except they don't have an answer to that.
I vaguely remember her. I was like, I'm Muslim. She's like, well, we accept every God and you're welcome, Lord Jesus. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm good. And she's like, but have you accepted Jesus? I was like, no, Jesus is cool. And she's like, okay, so you like Jesus. So it just became this thing. Ugh. It's like trying to get rid of a telemarketer.
And yeah, that's impressive that even though she was really hot, you were still trying to get rid of her. Because me, I would just pretend to be Christian until I could, you know, maybe take her out on a nice night, and then I'd tell her that I'm Muslim.
Well, see, bro, that's the problem right there.
That's
the problem, because you're going to fall for, you're going to end up on that supposed date and then realize you're not on a date because she's going to be like, oh, no, I'm not that kind of girl. Mm-hmm. And then you'll be like, oh, shit, I wasted all this time and bought her a coffee or whatever you buy her. The hat. And you'll be like, I thought I was going to get laid this whole time. You just wasted your time.
Yeah. I'd be happy with just a little hand-holding, maybe like a kiss on the cheek.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that might be a tougher reach. I don't know. I mean, I guess there's not. Is there any like contention between comedians of different religions? Do you feel like there's any of that?
I have never seen that. I mean, I think people that are angry are just angry, whether you're a comedian or you're a politician or whatever. So I'm sure there's. I don't know. I'm sure if you go to the comedy, the Comedy Cellar, they're pretty aggressive with one another. I'm sure that at one point when they were having a little argument, there might have been some guy who called someone a Jew or whatever.
Right.
I'm sure that's come out. But I personally feel like when you're in this business, it's hard to be. I mean, I'm sure we have racists in this business, but it's hard to be really racist as a comedian because we have so many different types and you end up hanging out with so many different types. And ultimately, you're either funny or not. So you get the respect out of being funny or not. You're either a hack or you're not.
I was going to say, I think I've only seen race arguments amongst bad comedians.
Yeah. Right.
Good comedians are just funny as funny.
Yeah, funny joke's funny joke.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, I see a lot of bad comedians just spend their day just arguing on Facebook all week, I think, you know?
Well, what it used to be was when I first, I don't know how you became a regular at the factory, but the way I did it was I stood in line.
Really? That's how you got passed to the factory?
Yeah, wow. You're the only person
I've ever met that got passed.
I actually did the work to tell the story. I stood in that line. I had a day job at the time, and I showed up at, I don't know, I got out of work at like 2 or 3 or whatever, went and stood in line. And it was interesting, my first time standing in that line. And like you said, and Facebook, none of that stuff was around. This was probably like 2000, maybe 2001, but I think it was 2000. So I saw all these guys arguing with each other, some of them about their place in line, some of them about whatever, just as the day went on. And I thought, oh, these guys all seem to be veterans of this line. Therefore, they must be good comedians because they must come here all the time. And exactly what you were saying, like out of 20 comedians perform, out of 20, I was decent, and there was one other guy who was decent. The other 18 were like literally crazy.
Yeah.
So you realize you're like, oh, these guys, you know, that's why they're arguing with each other. It's because they're just nuts and they're not there to put in the work. They're there to whatever, belittle the other guy because they think that'll make them better.
Yeah, it's interesting that a lot of the signups, because they have it here at the Comedy Store too, where the guy signs up and then you see like a lot of people end up getting on stage because sometimes it's potluck, they'll just randomly choose. Like 7 of them will literally be people that are looking for shelter, people that are looking for water, you know, people that are looking for sell their eggs. Some lady was here trying to sell her eggs like about 2 months ago.
The chef here who doesn't speak very much English, I'll go up.
I straight up saw a pimp up here one time. There was a pimp in a red outfit, and then the hostess that night, whoever it was, like when the pimp got off, he'd brought two of his bitches with him. So as the pimp got off, the hostess made fun of him, and then he yelled something at her like, I'll see you in the streets, bitch, or something. Like that. I was like, oh my
pimps
God.
Are real. Pimps go. Yeah. It's hard to really joke around with a pimp.
Yeah,
you know they have a serious business on hand.
I don't know. I've probably met a pimp, but I don't think I knowingly have met a pimp.
Yeah.
We should have one as a guest on the podcast.
Has any dude offered some chick to you and just randomly? That was probably a pimp if you've had that.
That's never happened to me.
Never happened.
No, except for the Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Happened to me in Minnesota, actually. Oh. I met a couple pimps outside of a place. And
how much did they want?
One of them said, you better hold on to your girl. That's what he said. And I was like, this is good advice. And then it was kind of awkward for her because she's just kind of in the middle of like.
Wait. So you were in Minnesota? Were you like at the club or you know?
I was at just a musical venue with this kind of Rubenesque woman, and I didn't really know her, you know. And
wait, Rubenesque? What does that mean?
Just kind of like 1800 sexy, you know. Like
you just met her that night.
Yeah, met her, and the pimp was just trying to maybe pick up, you know, new clientele or whatever. He's like, you better hold on to your girl.
Oh,
you know.
I thought he was doing a hard sale, like meaning like now that you got her in your arms, he's trying to be like, yo, you better hold on to your girl, and then he was going to start the negotiation there.
No, that's not a bad move. Get the woman to attach first.
That's what they do at like strip clubs when they go, oh, buy me a drink. And then you're like, you know, okay, buy you a drink. And then you're like, what the hell? And then they basically are aggressive about, you know what I'm saying? It's like upselling, right?
Yeah.
I had one time in Vegas, it was like 5 a.m, and I was coming home from wherever I was with my buddy, and these girls like basically popped out from behind like a plant.
Yeah.
And they were dressed like
plant hoes. Yeah.
Plant hoes. And they were dressed like regular girls.
Yeah.
And they kind of started like, hey guys, what are you guys up to? And again, it was one of those like, oh, I must look good, you know? And then I quickly realized there were hookers that were dressing regular and hiding behind plants. They were undercover hookers.
No.
That's how they roll, man. Huh?
So they were cops.
No, they were hookers.
Oh, regular hookers.
Undercover hookers, like camouflage hookers, like trying to make you think.
Dang.
That they're regular
like hookers
chicks.
With book bags.
Yeah, hookers with book bags, you
know?
Wow.
Yeah. That's kind of hot.
Yeah. Are you tired of doing all your own work? Time to expand your business? Well, you probably need to hire someone. And if you are hiring, do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Well, I can tell you that with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Yep, their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. You can find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. You know how much that is? That's nothing. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/allegedly. That's ZipRecruiter.com/allegedly. Yep, one more time. Try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/allegedly and find the help for your small business that you need. The best help. Check it out, ZipRecruiter.com. Yeah, there's a lot of escorts out there, man. And I'm friends with Vince Offer, who's the ShamWow guy. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
He had that accusation to get about fist fighting a hooker somewhere in Miami a long time ago.
Get a point for that. Be friends with that guy.
Oh, nice, yeah. Man. Yeah.
He's actually my brother-in-law. I'm really good friends with him.
Really? 2 points. That's crazy you never mentioned that.
Right. Yeah, just, you know, I don't like to brag about people I know, but some people do.
Really? You've watched me clean tables and never said a thing before, which is kind of ironic.
So what are you saying about him? What happened?
But he had this story one time, a hooker, he pushed a hooker, punched a hooker or something, hit a hooker.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
In Miami, it's about 14 years ago. Well, anyway, one day he starts telling me about it, and he's like, well, I met a girl at a club, at a nightclub. She comes back home. We hook up. Afterwards, she's like, you owe me money. He's like, I didn't know she was an escort. He goes, I know that I'm not the best looking guy, but I know that people know that I have money, and I know that I'm in Miami, and I know I'm at a nightclub, and this kind of thing doesn't happen to me a lot, but it happens sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
So then the girl says, you owe me money. And he's like, well, I didn't know you were a hooker. You know, if I wanted a hooker, then I would have got a hooker,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then shit escalated, and then the girl bites onto his face.
Oh, shit.
Right? And it tells him first, I'm not going to let go until you pay me. Oh. So then he literally has to, like, get this woman off of his face,
oh
you know?
Oh, my God.
And then that's when the police got called, showed up.
Based on that story, I've got to side with the guy, the ShamWow guy.
Yeah, yeah. At least 50-50. Yeah. You know, you got to settle on a, you
but
know.
There's two sides to every story, you know? I want to hear the prostitute side of the story.
He had a cannibal hooker, cannibalistic hooker.
She sounds wild.
Yeah, like Pussy Dahmer.
What, do you know what she looked like?
Nope, I don't know what she looked like. I bet there's pictures on the internet, though. Yeah. But he said that after that, no charges were pressed. It was just like that incident.
You know, I mean, hookers, I don't want to generalize, but they seem shady.
Yeah, I think if you're involved in an illegal business, even if you're not a bad person, just when you get into that arena, you become shady. It's like when you get into drug dealing. You may be the best drug dealer in the world, but you surround yourself with shady people, you're going to be a little shady.
Shit like that, that's shady. Like, right. You don't go to a party and make somebody laugh and tell them, you know, having a good time. And then go, all right, you owe me my corporate fee.
Yeah.
What? Yeah, I'm a professional comedian.
Speaking
of corporate fee. Yeah.
Speaking of shady, I don't know if you knew this, Theo, but Maz played a robber in the television show Malcolm in the Middle.
Well, that's true?
Yeah.
There are.
That is one of my favorite shows. I watched that growing up as a child before entering this shitty comedy business. And I was wondering, when because you were on the first season of that show, right? Or
yeah,
one of the early seasons.
First or second, very early.
Did you, when you were on the show, I don't actually, if I'm being honest here, remember the episode with you in it at this time.
Point away.
Dang, it's okay though.
But you know, I want to be honest. That's okay. Right. Sacrifice a point. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, honest, not a hooker.
But I love the show, and I'm wondering, when you were on that show, did you realize it was going to become this big hit, or were you just like, oh, this is some role I'm doing?
I think it was already kind of a good show, and at that point, I still had my day job, and I was auditioning for guest stars. So I got a guest star part on Malcolm in the Middle. Be honest with you, I didn't expect it. I went in, I auditioned. It's a couple guys who robbed the pharmacy or whatever, like the CVS that Jane Kaczmarek works for. And back then, it's not like I didn't have some grand plan as to how my acting career.
Sure.
Would, so it wasn't like, I wasn't like, oh, I'm only holding out for lead parts.
Right.
It was like, no, I'll take whatever you give
of
me.
Of course.
So I went and auditioned for the show that I knew was a fun show. I might've seen it a few times. And then I got this part that was just this, you know, where there's no accent. It wasn't an ethnic character. It's just a guy robbing a store. Mm. And it was great to do. And Jane Kaczmarek was super sweet. And I think they paid you like what's called top of show. So, you know, I had a day job as an assistant in an advertising agency where wow. I was making something like, I'm going to say $25,000 or $27,000 for the year.
Wow. That's pretty good money.
So then I get a week. Well, now, wait a minute. Then I get a week on Malcolm in the Middle where they give me $5,000 for a week.
Oh.
Like, damn, I can do this. So, yeah, it was, I mean, it was great. You're kidding me? You know, I'm going there. They're feeding me lunch. You said, I mean, come on.
And did you get to meet that, what's that one guy's name from Breaking Bad?
Bryan Cranston.
Did you get to meet Bryan Cranston?
I didn't have any episodes with him. Any scenes. I think he might have been on set and said hi at one point.
Or who played Malcolm?
Right. Frankie Muniz.
Frankie Muniz.
I didn't meet him. My whole scene was
just
me and this kind of, we were kind of bumbling idiot robbers, and the guy that I was with was even dumber. So we tried to rob.
You were the smart of the two.
I was the smart of the dumb guys.
Yeah.
And I have no, this, what's funny is I have no idea whatever happened to that guy again. Like, I've never seen him.
The other robber.
You know, sometimes it's funny. I was in a movie called The Interpreter. It was a big movie. It was like $80 million. What's his name? Pollock. Sidney Pollock was directing it. Sean Penn, Nicole Kidman, mm-hmm. Catherine Keener. It was a big movie. And I played a Secret Service agent in it. And it was a pretty cool part to do. It was a relatively small part, but it was one of the main Secret Service guys who's in the office with Sean Penn. Mm-hmm. And it was cool to do it, and I was excited. But then it's funny because once in a while I watch other movies, and I'm like, what happens to that guy who's playing like the third FBI guy? I never see him again.
Right.
So I was like, is that my future? Am I done? Am I never going to get another part?
Well, they don't have stand-up comedy to fall back on either.
They're just actors. Dude, I couldn't do it with it. If I was just an actor, I probably would have quit by now.
And when did you get into comedy?
So I got into comedy. I was a big fan of Eddie Murphy's as a kid. So mm-hmm. when I was about 10 years old is when he was really getting big in the early 80s.
Now, when you watched him, were you in America yet? Or were you?
Yeah, so I came to America
when you were 6 years old.
And then Eddie Murphy, I think, ends up on Saturday Night Live in like 80 or 81. Mm-hmm. And that's around the time when I heard his tape Comedian. I watched Delirious. And I mean, he was just my hero. And I wanted to be like him. But then coming from a traditional family or immigrant family, they want you to be a lawyer or a doctor,
of course,
maybe an engineer. Mm-hmm. So my parents really had me going another route. But I kept doing plays on the side, and I loved being on stage. And every teacher I had would always tell me, hey, you could do this. You got that thing about
being... Did they think you were homosexual?
Definitely. They were like, you are really good at giving hand jobs to dudes.
No, but I'm serious though, did they?
Oh, you mean my parents?
Yeah.
No.
Did people think that?
I mean the teachers. No. No, I don't think it was that. I don't think my
parents... Or if they did, they at least like swallowed that and buried it really deep.
No, my dad didn't. You know, it's funny because my dad, I don't think my parents ever went to like, oh, our son is gay. I think my parents went to a lot of immigrant cultures. There is a big emphasis on the community and what other people think. Mm-hmm. So if you have a respectable job, a respectable position, if you're, you know, Mr. Ambassador, or if you're Dr. This, I mean, those titles are huge. So I think that that's what they wanted.
In their mind,
you know, actor, comedian, singer is like somebody who is like lower on the totem pole. They're probably doing drugs.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? As you said, maybe they're gay. I don't know. But for them, it was like, it's not even an option in their mind. Cause they're like, this is not a reputable thing. What would the community say?
Right. If our son's a dancer, or so
how are they now?
A juggler.
Well, exactly. And well, now they've come around, but it took a while of me going back and forth. And finally, you know, for me, it actually, because the reason I was at the ad agency was because I still wanted to have like a regular job that would impress my family, like keep my family happy.
At what point in your comedic/entertainment career did your parents respect what you were doing?
Well, what happened was, so in my mid-20s when I was at the ad agency is when I realized, I was talking to this older guy there, and he was like, hey, he saw me doing a play again, and he's like, you're funny. Have you thought about doing this? I said, yeah, every acting teacher I ever had was telling me you should go for it. And I go, maybe I might try it when I'm in my 30s. And this is when I was 26. And he's like, listen, when I was in my 20s, there were some things I wanted to do. I never got around to doing it. Now I'm in my 60s. So I was like, if you really want to do it, do it. And it was a light bulb moment, and I went for it. And at first, at that point, my dad had gone back to Iran because he'd lost his money in America, and he went back to see if he could do any business with the properties he had in Iran. Mm-hmm. And I was living with my mom, and she was freaking out. Like, she was like, are you crazy? Like, you know, because you didn't become a lawyer. I was going to be lawyers because you didn't do that. You dropped out of a PhD program. You were going to be a professor. You left that. Now you want to be a comedian? Like, what the hell is wrong with you? And she and my grandmother actually suggested they go at least become a mechanic.
Right.
And I go, how'd you guys go from lawyer to mechanic? Yeah. I swear to God. And yeah, and their argument was, listen, people need mechanics. Nobody needs an actor.
Right.
So their whole thought was, and I realized they came from a revolution where their lives went upside down. So in their minds, when the revolution comes in America, you'll have a skill that you can take to Argentina and fix cars, as opposed to being some jackass comedian who can't tell jokes over there.
Right.
So anyway, they were very worried. And it wasn't until, it was a little while before I think, I mean, my mom was supportive. But I think once she started seeing, because I kept my day job, I was a pretty responsible person. I didn't say, hey, I'm out.
Yeah.
And actually, it actually worked out very serendipitously, because what happened was I was at the day job at the ad agency. I was looking to kind of quit. I was hoping I'd get a job that paid me, the amount that I made in a year, I could get out. If I got a big movie or something, I could make a decent amount, get out. So the ad agency started losing business. They started laying off their employees, and I got laid off. Mm. And like maybe a week later, I got a commercial. Mm. And then that commercial, you know, I made, I don't know, 20,000 over the year or something. Then I got another commercial. Then I got Friday After Next. So things just started trickling in.
Yeah.
And at first, my acting was paying for my comedy, because I do the, you know, midnight or 1 o'clock spot at the Comedy Store, make $15. That's not going to get me any money, right?
Right.
But eventually.
And you weren't headlining at this point?
It was like early 2000. Yeah. So it wasn't until the headlining really started coming. Like when we did the Access to Evil comedy tour, which was something that Mitzi Shore originally put together.
I didn't know that.
She put together. So in 2000, Mitzi was watching the news, and there was a latest uprising between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And she's Jewish, and she said, I think there's going to be a need for a positive voice for Middle Easterners in the very near future. This is before September 11th. So she goes, I want to do a Middle Eastern night. She goes, give me all my Middle Eastern comedians. And I was the only one here.
Yeah.
And so she wanted to do a night called the Arabian Nights. So
that's cool.
So it just so happened that she's seen Ahmed Ahmed in the main room on a specialty show. So she brought him on. I'd seen Aaron Kader. I said, there's a Palestinian dude. He came on. Sam Tripoli is half Armenian. Everyone came together, and we started doing this Arabian Nights show like every 6 months. And then eventually that thing grew to the Axis of Evil. And once it became the Axis of Evil, and me, Ahmed, and Aaron all owned it, then we started to tour with it and start making decent money. Mm-hmm. And then once that fell apart was when I was able to start touring on my own. And then
wait, that's why it fell apart, or why did Axis of Evil fall apart?
Because it was kind of like a rock band. There was always some turmoil, you know.
And Middle Easterners cannot get along.
It just can't. Middle Easterners can't get along. it really is like I hear all these groups that hate each other.
Yeah.
And I was good with both of them, but there was tension between those guys. Mm-hmm. And it was sometimes it would get fixed, and we'd have like a honeymoon period, and then another thing would happen. And so it was constant. And so it got to a point in 2007 where it was actually just starting to take off, because we came out on Comedy Central in 2007. Then we toured around the country. Then we went to the Middle East and actually did a tour in the Middle East. It was the first time a group of American comedians had gone to the Middle East. We did five countries. And when we got there, they had just played our special on a network there. So we were like rock stars suddenly. Like we were holding press conferences.
No.
It was crazy, dude. Like
really?
Like in Beirut, they got a 1,000-seat theater. They got us for one night, sold out. Two nights, sold out. Three nights, so five nights. Boom, 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 boom. It was crazy. We did 27 sold out shows in 30 days. The King of Jordan came to our show.
Wow.
It was just crazy shit going down. And so
that's so baffling. Cool. So what is that like? That acclaim there? Is it like? Is it just from men there? Are women even allowed to like go and,
that's a good question.
And I'm not trying to be weird or anything, but I'm just so curious. Like,
no, you're
what
absolutely
is that
right.
fame like there?
Well, first of all, every country is different. So you go to the United Arab Emirates, where Dubai is, and they're trying to be more modern and more open-minded. They still have a lot of rules where, for example, like a couple got arrested for like making out on the beach or something. Like there's rules that are weird, but they still exist. Mm-hmm. But overall, they're trying to be open to Western culture. So when mm-hmm. we do shows there, you had people from all kinds of backgrounds showing up. Guys, girls, all mixed together. You had Indians, you had American expats, you had all kinds of British people. And then you had the locals. So that was Dubai. Wow. Then you go to Beirut, Lebanon, where you have mostly Lebanese showing up. But Lebanon is also very hip and modern, and if anything, even more so. Like, they're almost European, and they're like, just go for it. Like, they took us out one night after one of our shows to a local club, and it was like the craziest DJ you've ever seen. Two girls grinding up on the wall, like making out and stuff. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? And the guy's like, bro, this is Wednesday. What do you see Saturday? I'm like, what? So it was like, Lebanon is crazy in that way. Then you end up in a place like, let's say Kuwait. Kuwait, there's no alcohol allowed. So there they have a little more, few more restrictions on what you can do, right? Like, the after party is in some guy's house, like in the basement. But for the most part, it was mixed. Like, I've done shows in Saudi Arabia, so that's a place where men and women don't mix. And so originally, when I did shows in Saudi Arabia, this wasn't part of this tour, it was another tour. There was a promoter who would do it. He had to do it in private places. So he would do a compound where a lot of expats are living, and it was like on a tennis court. So you'd have Saudi show up, but you had other people, and they were all mixed together.
Wow.
More recently, there's a prince over there who started doing public shows. And so when he does his shows, I did it one time, he has to have, because it's public, one side of the room is all dudes, one side of the room is all families, husbands, wives, and kids. So you'll do, like, you know, a joke about your kids, and the right side laughs, and all the dudes are just staring at you. Then you do like a penis joke, and the dudes laugh, and the side with the families, their jaws drop, because they're like, I can't believe he just said penis.
Wow.
So it's pretty trippy in that way. But overall, though, it was an interesting experience, because we were in 2007 when we went out there, we're getting so much attention. And it went really well. And ever since then, now, every one of those countries has its own budding comedy scene. And you'll get comedians there that you wouldn't expect to see. Like, a lot of American comedians go there. Because when we first went to a lot of these countries, I said, you know, talk about anything you want, but no sex, no religion, no politics.
Right.
And I was like, well, what am I going to talk about?
Yeah. Right.
But then, you know, we have comedians that, like, you know, their act might be very racy, even in America. And if I've seen a few of those guys over there, and I'm asking myself, how are they getting by with the rules that they're given? But my guess is that sometimes if, like, you're a big enough star, like if you're a movie star or something, let's say, whatever, you've done movies that they recognize, I think they're a little more lenient over there.
Right.
And they'll let you kind of go for it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting. So right when the group was, like, starting to become better known is when all the conflict kind of reached the head, and then we just split apart.
Wow.
But it was, it was a natural growth, because for me, it was like,
you were able to go off on your own.
Well, now I get to go and do my 1 hour special, right?
And that was the Netflix one?
That was my first one, was a Showtime one. It was called Brown and Friendly. Mm-hmm. The one now is my first Netflix one, which is Immigrant. That's the first time. Because the other ones have all ended up on Netflix, but this is my first original Netflix special, which is, you know, out now.
Yeah, and Maz and I actually were brought together by a tweet, too. I have a lot of my specials satire. So at the end, I'm like, you know, I'm saying that, you know, big black women are hogging all the wheelchairs at the airport, just like really just going in everything. And then I'm like, Persian people, get out, you know, that's like how it closes. And then it immediately, some kid tweets at us like, so funny, it closes, Persian people, get out. And then now you should watch Maz Jobrani, right, on his Netflix thing.
How funny was that? So I guess Netflix, for whatever reason, because he said
the word Persian, they linked
the context of what he was saying. And it said, oh, if you like this, you'll like this. It's hilarious. I was like, how funny was that, dude?
That is interesting, though. It's like, as you're kind of known as this Middle Eastern comedian, it's kind of, a lot of your following is that. Do you ever, because I've seen you do Comedy Juice at the Improv and kill for, you know, a mostly white crowd, whatever, all the crowds. Do you ever wish that you were more of a general comedian that didn't have this niche audience?
I don't consider myself a Middle Eastern comedian. I'm a comedian who happens to be Middle Eastern, but also I'm very American. I grew up here.
Right.
So my audience is funny because it depends. So what happened was, originally, when I was first doing stand-up, I don't think anybody in the, like, Persian community or these other communities really knew who I was. Mm-hmm. So I was here. I was, that's why my material, I think, crosses over, because my material is me. I'm a very American experience, right. immigrant experience, but I said I'm very American. So I was used to performing here at the Comedy Store mm-hmm. and the Laugh Factory in front of just generic audiences.
Yeah.
And what's happened is because there's been more and more comedians of this these backgrounds in the recent past, I think we're starting to see more and more people from these backgrounds coming to shows. So if you come and see me when I tour, like if you came and saw me in Irvine, there's a lot of Persians in Irvine. So you come to a show in Irvine and you're going to get like, you know, 50, 60% Persians, 40% others. Mm-hmm. But you come to Denver and you see a show, there's like 30 Persians and there's 250 of others.
Right.
So it really has become this thing where it depends where you see me. And I personally love having a mixed group. Like you'll see in the special, I start asking people, where are you from? Where are you from? And there's a girl from Ukraine, and there's a dude, just a white dude, and then there's like a Pakistani, there's an Indian. So there's people from all over.
Yeah,
so I personally feel that the comedy works no matter where. I mean, the only way, like, I would say that, like, if you're a little, like, I would say my politics are a little more left. Mm-hmm. So I think if you're a little more left, you're going to enjoy my stuff more. But then there's also people that are so far left that they'll get offended at some of the stuff you say. Because we're in this era now where, you know, if you make a racial comment,
they'll get offended by ironic, a word.
Yeah. They don't get it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I think it's just like, you just do your thing. You just keep playing your voice the way you want to. And eventually people, you'll
we'll
be surprised.
Find you.
You know what one of my like favorite things is? When I do a meet and greet. So, first of all, I kind of know where people know me from. So I've been doing this show on NPR called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is a fake quiz show that they do every weekend. Mm-hmm. And it's got a big white audience and a lot of older white people. So if I'm you know doing a meet and greet afterwards and I see older white people waiting, I know they come up and be like, wait, wait, don't tell me. Thank you. And then I did Friday After Next, which had like a big urban audience. So if I see like some like Latino dude or like some black dude that kind of like is a little more hood and uh-huh. they come up, I'm like, and they'd be like Friday After Next. But the ones that I never have, I have no idea how they find me. I've had like Japanese or like Chinese or like Vietnamese, like hardcore Asian, but not Japanese Americans, Japanese, right. Barely speak English.
Majorani.
And they're giggling and then they come up and they're like, oh, this is great. Like, this is so good. I'm like, where did you see me? I have no idea. The one other thing that I think might've happened was I did a TED talk. You guys know TED, the TED talk?
Yeah, of course.
So I did a TED talk.
Did you really?
Yeah, what was your TED talk about?
Two of them. Basically, the first one was the guy who was the producer of that tour that we did in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. He had done a TED talk in Dubai as like a TEDx in Dubai. And the guy who was the main booker for the TED talks told him, hey, why don't you come to the main TED talk in England, in Oxford, do a talk about bringing comedy to the Middle East and get one of the comedians to come and do a talk / stand-up show. Mm. So I just basically took my stand-up and turned it into a talk.
Right.
And then off of that, they did another one in Doha, Qatar, and they invited me to go do that as well.
Dang.
So like a couple of, like that one has like, I don't know, 5 million views online.
Wow.
So I get like, some people find me through that. So you just don't know. So it's just, you just keep doing your thing, man. Yeah. And eventually people will show up.
Do you think it matters these, like, because I'm sure you've probably seen at least a breadth of things change in the past 20 years, right?
Yeah.
As, you know, as we all kind of have. But in your time in comedy, do you think it matters what you do now or where you come from now or what?
Well, it's part of, listen, it all is about, like, people ask me, like, what do you write about? It's what interests me, right? So it's what interests you. So I, you know, first of all, once in a while when I go on stage, I go, I'm from Iran. If there's jokes coming off of that, I kind of need to say that. If I were a black guy, you know I'm a black guy.
Right.
So I don't need to say I'm a black guy.
Right.
Right?
Because I could think he's Latino. I could think he's Native American.
Whatever,
I could think
right?
he's just, yeah.
Yeah.
Grew up near like a fire.
Yeah.
You know, you can think a lot of different
he's
stuff.
He's got a great tan, that guy.
Yeah.
So, but you know, you too. Like sometimes when you want to tell someone your story, you kind of go, this is where I'm from or this is where I grew up.
Right.
So I think that kind of can be part of it. It's not that it's important necessarily. I've done sets where I've intentionally said, I'm not even going to mention my background. I'm just going to do the set. And the set's gone well. And we have jokes about other stuff.
Right. Do you find though that these days, I mean, do you like maybe 15 years ago, you'd be like, oh, well, I'm not going to do that because I want to stay in this certain lane. Whereas these days now, it doesn't even matter what you do anymore. You just want to find your audience. I mean, you have Jennifer Aniston coming back to television. You have celebrities who are doing commercials now that they never would have done 20 years ago when I was growing up. You know,
I never strategized like that. I always was like, I'm talking about what I think is funny to me. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about what I think my experiences. So originally, when I first started, I took a stand-up comedy class.
Yeah, me too.
Which one?
I took Judy Carter's
me
class.
Me too.
There you go.
Who's that? Should I be taking a stand-up comedy class? Too late for me.
Well, that explains everything. You just got to vote for that.
You're already a bad comic, are you?
Yeah, it's too late. I'm just stuck where I'm at.
Tutor.
That's why I'm here.
So when I took that class, you know, one of the things, you know, they teach you is like talk about you and like break it down. Who are you? So really, for me, it was like growing up Iranian in America is hard. Okay, write jokes around that.
Right.
So I started doing that. And then a lot of times early on, it was like, I'm Iranian at this, I'm Iranian at that. But then eventually, I realized some of those experiences are not just Iranian experiences, they're immigrant experiences. I remember I was doing a joke about how my grandmother used to hide her money in her bra. And this was the Laugh Factory, and there was a couple of Mexican girls in the audience that were laughing at the joke. And I was like, oh shit, their Mexican grandmother puts her money in her bra as well. And so that made me then refer to like immigrants, this is my immigrant experience.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then again, I also think I don't think that isolates anyone who's not an immigrant, because it's all about how you paint the picture. So if you say, you know, I come from an immigrant background, this is what it's like, blah, 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 blah. Like, for example, I'm doing a bit now where I talk about my kids, and I talk about how I keep going to their school events and how I was at one of their school events and I realized that my parents never came to my school events. And then I realized, you know, I was born in Iran and I'm an immigrant. I go, when you're an immigrant, you don't want your parents to come to your school events, because when immigrant parents show up at school events, they out you.
Right.
So it's like they walk in, they're like, hello, we are immigrants. Right. And you're like, Dad, shut up. So the point is, you know, by painting that picture, just taking a second to paint the picture, as opposed to going like, I can't assume, like I can't go into the room and be like, you know what it's like having immigrant parents, right? You know, you're embarrassed by them, right?
Right.
And now the white audience is going, no, I don't know. I didn't have immigrant parents. You know, you're not telling them about your story.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I've never strategized and said, I need to talk about this, I need to talk about that. You know,
right.
I mean, I guess once in a while there's been jokes I've tried that I felt that maybe is not even like it's kind of not in my voice and point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried it and I've felt my audience like kind of tense up, and maybe I've gone like, okay, that joke is too racy for my standard audience,
right,
that come to my tours, but I can still do it at midnight at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. So I can save it till then. Yeah. Time and a place. Right.
So do you embarrass your kids when you go to their events?
I don't think I do. They're still at the age. They're cute, man. They're 6 and 10. They're still at that age.
Do you have one that you love more than the other?
Absolutely.
As well?
And he knows it.
does now. They're beautiful children. I've seen them. I saw them at your premiere. Your wife is beautiful. Is it still your wife, right?
Yeah, she's my wife. She's Indian. Yeah. So they got her looks. And she's, and the kids, actually, my daughter's 6. My son is 9. And they're still at that age. It's very cute. They have a thing, it's called hoopathon, where they get the kids to come out, they run in circles around the gym, and then they shoot baskets. So they're still at that age where they're like running by you and they're waving and they're like, oh, and they want to see their parent there. And actually, this was interesting. So the hoopathon, the kids do the shooting and then the parents get to shoot. And in all honesty, I still don't know how they make money now, because when I was a kid, you would say, hey, for every shot, I'm going to get $5 or a dollar, whatever it is. Now the kids just shoot and then the parents donate somewhere. I don't know. I don't know if that's part of like nobody loses kind of a mentality, but I'm like, can we just make them?
Oh, yeah. Because now there's no kid that's like, I've raised the most money.
I think we should bring that back. But anyway, that's besides the point. What they did is they afterwards, actually, this is one of the ways they made money. Like you pay like, I don't know, $20 and you get to then shoot. It's a layup, then a free throw, then at the top of the key, and then you go to the halfway, you know, half court, and you shoot. And each one gets a certain number of points. And obviously, if you make that half court shot, if you make all the shots, including the half court shot, you're usually like, there's like one guy, maybe two guys that do that, and then they win some like prize that a parent donated. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of funny, because my son, when he first started going to school, he must have been like, I don't know, 3 or 4, I forget. But he was at that age, I think, where to him still his father was Superman.
Right.
And like I could do no wrong. And I remember watching him watch me shoot. And I think he was so proud. And I went up and I think I might have hit like the layup, maybe the free throw. And then after that, I missed everything from there on.
Yeah.
I remember seeing the look of disappointment on his face. Like, wait a minute. It was almost like, dude, I told all my friends that you're the best basketball player and you can't make this. Like, he was so disappointed. Flash forward, like 2-3 years later, I'm sitting there, you know, make the shots, half court shot, go for it. Bam, hit no. it. My son lit up like, my God, like he was so excited. And then he was such a star because all the other kids saw it the whole day. The kids were like, you know, your dad did it. Your dad did it. Totally. I was such a star. And then the irony of all that is my wife, meanwhile, when I make that shot, everyone saw it. Everyone's like, ah, I'm like, oh my God. Turn around. My wife's in some conversation with some lady. Look at the shot.
Shot.
I don't know what they were talking about.
Dude, nobody knows what they're talking about, dude. Yeah. God, bro. Yeah. That's the worst, man. Yeah.
If your kid told you that he wanted to be a comedian, would you be okay with that?
Absolutely. Coming from the background where my parents pushed me away from doing what I love doing, I'm 100% into them doing whatever they want. And it really is like, you know, as long as they're passionate or they want to put in the time and the effort, I'm down. Like this, I met this other dad recently who was telling me, he goes, his son wants to play baseball. And he said, I told him, and I think his son's in high school. He said, I told him, as long as you're the one waking me up, I'll get up at 4 a.m. and play catch with you. But I don't want to be the one waking you up.
Right. Oh, that's a good statement.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they got to have self-discipline.
Do you consider yourself a successful comedian?
Yeah, I do. It's funny. I heard Dom Herrera say it one time. He's broken it down a few times where he goes, there's only, I don't know, a few hundred or several hundred comedians who are touring and making a living doing it.
Yeah.
And he goes, think about it. There's like 700 professional baseball players. There's probably fewer comedians making a good living doing stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And so for me, really, it was like at a certain point, yeah, I feel very, I'm not religious or anything, but I feel blessed in a way that I can do this. I really love doing what I do. I haven't had a day where I was regretting driving to work. You know, I mean, the travel is hard now just because you have a family and all this stuff, but I love it. I mean, I get paid and you know, to do what we love. We won. I mean, I have no complaints at all. I hope I can, like, part of the little bit of anxiety I have in the back of my mind is like, when will I stop being relevant? When will I look in the audience and it's a bunch of 20-year-olds and I'm 50 or 60?
When will you be Argus Hamilton?
Argus,
he's here still, but he's still
He still shows up and does, like, you know, topical stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, but I'll give you, there was this other lady, I forget her name, but she was in the Comedy Store maybe, I don't know, I'm going to guess 5-6 years ago, doing like Cher and then doing, I don't know, like real, like, old time impressions. And mm-hmm. she had been a comedian who was around in the early 80s.
Wow.
When those were appropriate.
Right.
But now she's still doing
still
it.
Still doing Cher impressions.
And it was sad. I was watching it. I go, oh my God. I go, Jesus. Like, is she aware of this?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They're probably just, she's too scared to try new things. Who knows?
Well, maybe she stopped. Yeah. I don't know what she's doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe she just stopped evolving at a certain point, or she got busy. She had children. Who knows? I saw Jamie Kennedy one night. This years ago, who I think is just one of the funniest dudes, like, could listen to that guy tell stories or just be around him forever. But he was doing like a Ozzy Osbourne impersonation, but like way after he should have been doing it.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of realized as he was doing it, like, this is the last time I'm doing this.
Yeah.
But it was just one of those moments that made me think, like, wow, like, yeah, you have to evolve.
You have to evolve. And I had to, it's funny because, like, I've had bits where I go, okay, I want to reference that event. How do I reference that event and make it somewhat evergreen or you know, irrelevant, right? Right? Or I learned the difficulty in some of this. I was trying to do a whole bit about how I can't wait till I'm in my 70s, because I was like, once you're in your 70s, you can do whatever the hell you want. Like, nobody cares. Like, you know, like, in the 20s, you care. Like, 20s, you don't care, but then, like, 30s, you have mortgage and blah, 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 blah. But by 70s, I started giving a list of people and the things they were doing. And one of the people I brought up was Marlon Brando, who, if I don't know if you ever saw it, but there was an interview he did with Larry King towards the end of his life. He was probably like in his early 80s or late 70s. Mm-hmm. And Larry King's asking him all kinds of questions. And the whole time it was this, supposed to be this like hard-hitting interview. And Marlon Brando the whole time kept trying to get Larry King to eat cookies. Mm. And the whole time he's like, Larry, yeah, cookies, have a cookie. And it became this thing. And it was so funny that they even did it on Saturday Night Live. They had John Travolta, who was the guest play Brando, feeding them cookies. But it was funny. So I talked about Brando and I looked in the audience. Again, this was the Laugh Factory. Looked in the audience and I'm talking about Brando and I see this guy who looks to me like he should know Marlon Brando. It looked like he was like in his late 20s or something. He was looking at me with like a blank stare. And I go, you know Marlon Brando, right? And he goes, no. I was like, how old are you? He's like 24 or something. And I was like, oh my God, there's a generation that doesn't even know Marlon Brando. Yeah. I mean, that's scary shit.
Man.
You gotta evolve.
And then because of that, you have to force yourself to watch this dumb new wave of YouTube stars. I don't want to have to watch YouTube stars so I can know who they are.
Yeah, it's true, huh? It's interesting. Yeah, it's like, and how do you stay in the know now when in the know has gotten where finding sources for in the know has gotten so exponential? Like it used to be when I was in high school and college, you came home, you watched MTV, right? Like that was the only place to get cool. Like, you watched it.
It was so cool that if you told people you watched other things, it wasn't cool. Like I would lie to my friends and be like, oh, I just watch MTV.
Yeah, I wasn't watching. Life I remember saying Corgi. That. You know, that's crazy, dude. Yeah.
I don't watch the Disney Channel. That's for gays.
It's for gay children or gay children. Animals. Yeah. You know, really, really humane.
Even though
animals.
I watched the Disney Channel.
Yeah,
all the time.
I did too, man. I used to dance around in my living room a lot. I used to just put the TV on silent and fucking dance, man.
But you're right. You know who's done actually kind of a good job of kind of aging. I think is like when I've seen Seinfeld do his bits on the late shows. He still is talking about things that are relevant, whether it's, and his point of view is an interesting point of view. So you can be, I mean, Carlin did it. You can get older and do jokes that make fun of younger people and younger people still can laugh as long as you're in that conversation. So like, for example, like your take on the YouTube stars, like if you have people that, let's say there's a YouTube star named, I don't know, Bumbo or whatever his name is, and you're in a room with these guys who know Bumbo, and you're an older dude making fun of Bumbo. Mm-hmm. They're gonna love hearing you talk about Bumbo.
True.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, hearing that take, man. Well, I noticed too, just watching you, man. I noticed that I think you do a really good take on fatherhood, you know, and stuff like that. And so I really enjoy listening to it.
Well, thanks, man.
Yeah, it's funny. It seems like. Yeah, so if any of those concerns ever start to, you know, rattle in your head, I wouldn't let them flare up yet.
Well, you know? I always use the example of Eric Estrada, because I go, there was a time when Eric Estrada was on Chips, and he was probably looking around going like, I am the shit. Mm-hmm. This thing is going to last forever. And then whatever, a year later, he's on Telemundo going, you know, hi, I'm Eric Estrada. You know,
do you have, he's selling irons now or something. Whatever. He's selling omelets.
Right?
I don't know who that is.
He's handsome, though.
He looks good. He looks good.
You don't know
who
it is.
I don't know.
So you don't even know Eric Estrada. It was a show called Chips. You remember the movie Chips? Just came out.
Uh-huh.
It was based on a TV show, and Eric Estrada was the Latino dude in there, and he's kind of a hunky looking dude.
Yeah.
But he just had, you know, the show was a hit, probably what, late 70s, early 80s for a minute. But again, it's just this thing of, I think as long as you stay in the game, you keep writing stuff. Or you're right, you have a perspective that people can relate to. And if you're sincere, like a lot of, I mean, all of my stuff, and I know your stuff too, it all comes out of real life.
Yeah.
So people, if you can, you know, I think we become storytellers. So if you can keep it sincere and then find punchlines, because that's where I think, that's where the comedian comes in. You got to take that real thing and find a punchline in it. Even if that punchline didn't happen, you got to add it to it. So that
you can embellish the truth as
you
a comedian.
To. You have to, because you can't just be like, oh yeah, I went to Starbucks and I ordered the wrong coffee and then I left.
Yeah.
All right, well, what else happened in the middle, right?
Yeah, somebody need to get molested.
Yeah, molested. Now you got something.
You have something. Yeah, you need, like I agree. It's, I don't know. It constantly is interesting to me how this career evolves. And I'll say this, is that once you, there were times where I'm like, I can't make any more material. I mean, I could, but I know what I have, I can put somewhere. It's almost like I'm just waiting for a place to put it. And then once you have an opportunity to do a special or to do a half hour or to do, then it's like your brain almost then can switch into another gear.
Absolutely. It's amazing. One of the best feelings is when you do have a special and then you start touring afterwards and people come see you and you're like, oh wow, I need new material because they've seen the special. And then after 6 months to a year of touring, you start going, oh wow, that bit that was a killer on the special, I'm not even doing it anymore. Oh wow, I'm not doing that. I'm gonna do it. And it's such a good feeling. You're like, oh, somehow authentically, just organically, a whole new hour came about. And that's because you just keep talking about your life and your experiences and just riffing and riffing. It is a good feeling, dude.
Yeah, it's inspiring, and it makes you feel that then it's the first time I ever felt like I was in the right job, that I was in the right place. I mean, I wished it a lot of times, and I knew I felt like I was entertaining people. But until that happened, where I didn't have faith really a lot of times that I would come up with new stuff.
Yeah.
And then to have new stuff, to know that your like brain or your spirit or the powers that be in the universe are on board with whatever you're trying to stay a part of.
Yeah.
Man, that was really, really relaxing.
So refreshing. It's helpful for you to be forced to write new stuff, you're saying. If you put it out there on your special, then you have to come up with new stuff.
Yeah, I was afraid to let it go. I think afraid that I would never have anything out. Like, just that maybe I didn't have enough experiences or it wasn't interesting enough.
But that's also why these nights when you show up and there's eight people or it's like it's a best Kevin Nealon new material night where the people are forced to do new material.
Yeah.
Those are great nights because then you end up riffing something you thought, you know, your subconscious is working on it. So yeah,
it's tricky. It's a tricky time, man. But you can catch a lot of Maz's views and humorous views on Immigrant, and they can catch also Jimmy Westwood.
Yeah,
they can find it on.
Yeah, it's on iTunes. Jimmy Westwood is like the word Westwood, but with V's. V-E-S-T-V-O-O-D. Jimmy Westwood, American hero. I describe it as like the Persian Pink Panther. It's a slapstick comedy, and it's on iTunes. It's
and Maz has got a podcast on all things comedy. It's not there anymore.
We stopped doing Minivan Men.
Well, you could go listen to the old episodes of Minivan Men.
You can check out the old episodes of Minivan Men, and we'll add Maz's social media as well. And it's just what
@MazJobrani.
Yeah, cool, man. Well, we appreciate you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
And chatting with us. We have to finish up this game now. What are we at right now?
Looks like Ari's got two and Theo's got three.
Okay, cool. So we need a last round, 30 seconds. We each have 30 seconds to do what? What are we gonna?
Explain.
Name as many capitals of Middle Eastern countries as you can.
All right, I think I'm gonna.
Okay, do is go back and forth until somebody gets one
back
wrong.
Back and forth, yeah, exactly.
Okay, do you want to go first? All right.
What if I don't know any?
Well, then we'll know in just a second.
He needs one. He needs one.
Okay, Cairo.
Ooh, nice.
Is that one?
That was Cairo, Egypt.
I knew that was one.
Yeah.
Okay, what about Doha?
Oh, nice.
Where's that one?
Yeah.
What's that one of?
Qatar.
Jerusalem.
Oh, that'll work. Yeah, but is it Jerusalem or is it?
That's the capital of the Bible, dude.
Yeah, and I think I'm pretty sure that the embassy. Yeah, it is. Is it Jerusalem of Israel? Would it be?
If we don't know, we have to assume I'm right.
Because <Okay. laughs> Tel Aviv might have been, but okay.
Tel Aviv is a bigger city, but I think Jerusalem
is the capital.
It's the capital of the Holy Land. Well, Holy Land. Let's say that.
Someone's
gonna
send you a message and tell you.
Yeah.
Go on.
Okay, I'll go with Addis Ababa.
You made a name up. No, that's not a real place.
Ethiopia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, now that's in Africa.
Yeah,
we'll
that's not.
You.
But
we'll
there's a lot.
Oh, now we can just start naming capitals
activity.
Of places.
Addis Ababa is a good one. That's
yeah,
a good one.
If we could just name capitals of countries, that make things
a
lot easier.
The judge, right now, it's your turn.
I'm going with that. I'm giving it the same way we gave you Jerusalem. I'm giving up.
Thank you, judge.
Dubai.
No, the capital of the United Arab Emirates is actually Abu Dhabi.
Ooh, at Abu Dhabi.
But Dubai's got an indoor place where you could go snowboarding. That's pretty
cool. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true, yes.
Yeah, but that doesn't count as a capital these days. These millennials, man.
Yeah.
So I think that gives me the win.
Yeah, you got four, you got two, you won.
You beat me last time, you guess.
It's okay. Yeah. It was a good game. You know what? It just goes to show I need to educate myself on capitals of Middle Eastern countries because I actually was surprised I got one and a half of them.
Before we leave and have somebody write up something, let's just Google capital of Israel and we'll get that real quickly. Is it Jerusalem?
I can't believe that you don't even know this, Ari. Is it?
I know. I went on Birthright last year.
Wow, birth wrong, bro.
You went there, you didn't listen, huh? You didn't
No, I just wanted the free trip. I just wanted to kiss Jewish girls.
Bam. Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right.
See,
I listen. That. Yeah. I listen real good.
Right. You can find Ari at Ari Manis, ArimanniS.
That's perfect.
And me at Theo Vaughn. Do you have any upcoming dates that people can come check out at Mus?
Yeah, I'm going to be in Glendale doing something called Stars on Brand in August. Mm-hmm. I'm also doing a fundraiser for Tree People. It's an outdoor show for these a nature walk up here in Beverly Hills. And then I'm going to do Doha, Qatar in September, and I'm doing the Irvine Improv in October. All of it at MazJobrani.com.
MazJobrani.com. Awesome, man. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. This was a fun conversation.
Yeah, it was nice. Thanks. We enjoyed it. Thank you so much for Allegedly. We'll see you next week.